Well, this year, as fast as we do a show about something, it gets in the news and it changes. We talked about Arctic policy and the State House passed an Arctic policy bill. We talked about our oceans and now a study comes out on the vulnerability of our coastal communities to ocean acidification. Good morning, I'm Steve Heimel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska on the cutting edge of change. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to learn more about ocean acidification today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we've been following the issue of the souring of our oceans for several years now, and in the course of that, we've had a couple of conversations with our guest today, Jeremy Mathis, who has now become director of the Ocean Environment Research Division of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, and joins us by telephone from there, which is in Seattle instead of Fairbanks, where he might rather be. Jeremy, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much, Steve.
You were recently here for the Marine Science Symposium, and you gave a keynote speech that was just kind of an overview of how fast our research has progressed in this issue of ocean acidification, the idea that we get more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is past 400 now, and there's just a chemistry that takes place in the ocean where much of that carbon dioxide, instead of staying in the atmosphere, goes into the ocean. The problem is that the chemistry changes, and it's all happened so fast that the species have not had time to adapt to it. And so we're busy trying to track it and see what it means. And I guess it's the tracking of it that is the biggest news, wouldn't you say? I mean, just in the last couple of years, our monitoring abilities have seemed to have improved greatly for being able to see how the fluctuations go in this acidification.
That's absolutely true. 5 years ago, when we started out, we had virtually no measurements of ocean acidification anywhere around Alaska. And since then, we've had a tremendous buildup of resources and assets that we've been able to put into the water that have allowed us to really quantify the change that has occurred and then be able to project what we think might happen over the next few decades in the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, and in the Arctic Ocean. And so we're doing a really good job of making these observations in all three of Alaska's oceans right now.
And can you tell me what is the nature of that? Is it moorings? Is it vessels of opportunity? Is it how close is the data getting? Because you know, you and I both know that there's huge fluctuations, daily fluctuations, and so forth.
Absolutely. Well, we've had tremendous build-out in the technology available to us in the past few years, and so that's allowed us to provide a variety of tools that we can use to monitor ocean acidification across both time and space scales. So we have our buoys and our moorings that are sitting out at fixed locations making dozens of measurements every day at the same spot that are telling us how water conditions change over time. Then we deploy our ships that can cover large areas in a fairly short amount of time to give us the spatial coverage that we need. And this past year, in 2014, we did a project in Prince William Sound and out on the Gulf of Alaska coast outside of Seward, where we deployed autonomous gliders. It was two gliders that looked like a big yellow surfboard that had the same instrumentation on them that we're able to put on our moorings, and we can pilot these things around remotely, and they were able to stay out for about 4.5 months and collect millions of data points about ocean acidification in the Prince William Sound and northern part of the Gulf of Alaska that's really going to revolutionize our thinking and our understanding. So it's been the ability to collect multiple data sets through multiple platforms that's really changed the way that we can think about ocean acidification. And our NOAA administrator, Dr. Sullivan, is fond of using the term environmental intelligence. And that's sort of what we're changing our thinking into, is we want to not just collect data, we want to collect integrated environmental intelligence that can immediately inform stakeholders around Alaska about the potential outcomes of ocean acidification.
Kind of interesting having an astronaut as a boss, isn't it?
It's absolutely great to have an astronaut as a boss because she knows what it's like to work in challenging environments and the value of the data that we can gather.
Yeah. Well, I want to get on to this issue of, you know, vulnerability and you know, what we have learned about that. But before I do, I just have to know a little bit more about the technology. I mean, first off, everybody just absolutely loves to know more about drones and gliders and all that sort of thing. And I just have to. How in the world, if you can keep these things in the water for so long, what is the mechanical means whereby that much data can be stored?
Well, that's a great question. The data is all sent back to our headquarters here in Seattle via satellite transmission. So all the data is sent in real time as it's collected. And the gliders themselves have solar panels on them that charge daily that keep the instrumentation running. And then they're propelled by wave energy. They have a what looks sort of like a fin that protrudes down in the water 5 or 6 feet down. And that fin captures the wave energy, and that provides the propulsion for the gliders to be able to move around. And then we can steer them remotely from here in Seattle using nothing more than an iPad. It's software that's loaded on an iPad. So we have a group of pilots that literally pass this iPad back and forth to each other over the course of a day, because we steer them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week when they're out, so we can pilot them in real time and guide them to certain features or to certain areas that we want to look at. We can, you know, maneuver them around islands or other obstacles that are in the way, and we can even do real-time ship avoidance, because we were working in a major shipping channel working in Prince William Sound, and so we were able to really carry out the mission remotely piloting the gliders from Seattle.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and email is talk@alaskapublic.org. We're kind of exploring sour oceans here with Jeremy Mathis of the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory of NOAA, who's talking to us from Seattle, but has a long background up in Alaska, where he started the monitoring program for ocean acidification at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Do I have that right, Jeremy?
That's exactly right, and we still have our active group, the Ocean Acidification Research Center, which I still am heavily involved with, is our local connection there in Alaska that's still carrying out a number of these projects that we're doing. And so it's the collaboration between the two organizations, between NOAA and the University of Alaska Fairbanks, to allow us to have the success that we've had and to do a significantly more than either one of the organizations could do independently.
So I seem to recall that maybe even it was 2 years ago, but it might have been just last year, where measurements came in from the Beaufort Sea, and they were really quite acidic. Has there been more? Has it got better density on these observations now?
We do. We were continuing to make observations in the Beaufort Sea, and we do see that it's one of the areas that has some of the lowest pH values that we've observed. So ocean acidification just seems to be happening faster in the Beaufort Sea relative to other areas like the Gulf of Alaska or the Bering Sea. And there are a number of different processes that drive that, things like sea ice melt and a great deal of runoff from the Mackenzie River condition the Beaufort Sea to have a greater propensity for ocean acidification that's driven by carbon dioxide accumulation from the atmosphere. So we are watching the Beaufort Sea very carefully, and we do see from a trending standpoint that it's trending towards those lower pH values and being more acidic sooner rather than later.
Now, there are seasonal factors there, and there is a paper that you're the lead author of, but everybody else is involved with, Feely and Cooley and all kinds of people that I am familiar with from this field, in Progress in Oceanography, which hasn't actually come out in print, but I guess everybody's already read it.
Well, it's available online. It's free. It's available for the public online. If you just Google it, anybody can download it. We've set it up to be open access because we wanted as many people to be able to have access to it and to read it as possible.
Yeah, and it's I think in some ways, I mean, I can't pretend to understand all the equations and so forth. But it's like there's a copious amount of information in here. And one thing that comes out is because you are looking at, as it says, ocean acidification risk assessment for Alaska's fishery sector. Well, that makes many ears prick up in Alaska, Jeremy, as you know, the minute you mention fisheries and risk. And what you are finding is basically that the worst times for acidification are not the times of greatest vulnerability for the population, for the most part. I mean, because the larval stages are pretty much around in the spring, and the worst part of the ocean acidification tends to happen in the fall, right?
That is right.
So that's one thing anyway.
So, but to expand on that, so what we did find right now is that you're absolutely correct. The larval stages, which is where we think from a biology standpoint, the organisms are most vulnerable to ocean acidification, do occur earlier in the year. And then throughout the summer, the intensity of ocean acidification does build in a lot of places. But what we're also finding is that because CO2 is continuing to accumulate in the atmosphere and in the ocean, the duration of those ocean acidification events are going to start getting longer and longer. So they'll happen earlier in the year and they'll persist later into the year. And at some point, that may start to overlap with the vulnerable life stages of a number of the organisms that we're concerned with. So you're right, the overlap isn't there right now, but as CO2 continues to build, the window between species vulnerability and the most intense periods of ocean acidification will begin to get smaller.
Okay, so we have a, I don't know if I'd call it a perfect storm exactly, but we have a situation where the waters on the bottom will tend to be quite acidic, and then the waters on the top and the runoff waters will also. And when they come together...
That's exactly right.
Yeah, when they come together, there's where our problem can be.
That's true. So it's two different processes that are driving this. There's a surface process and a subsurface process, and they are being affected by different things, but when they come together, they're shrinking that available habitat where an organism that may have a negative consequence because of ocean acidification will begin to feel the pressure from both the surface and the bottom.
Do we know yet if pteropods can recover? In other words, if they start, their shells dissolve fairly easily, it's a kind of snail and it's quite vulnerable. Do we know if they actually have their ability to recover?
Well, we do know that they can regenerate their shells. If you know, even if you find a pteropod that the shell has experienced quite a bit of dissolution, as long as the little animal in there itself is still alive, then if it's moved back into waters that aren't corrosive to it, it can regenerate that shell. But in the meantime, it has become far more susceptible to predator behavior by losing its shell. It's certainly more vulnerable. And so that's our concern, is that during that time when the shell structure has begun to dissolve or is weakened, that they'll be really vulnerable to increased predation.
And somebody comes along and eats them all, and then they're not there for the salmon.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you much, Jeremy Mathis, for agreeing to put up with my questions here on this program. Let's see what some people across Alaska have to say to you. We'll start with Bob, who joins the program from Soldotna. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bob.
Hello. Greetings from the beautiful upper west side of Soldotna. Well, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I probably should have been. You know, our oceans have changed. We know that they were where life started on this world. At one time, they were so acidic, you know, a nail would dissolve in them. And through the eons, the gases and the microorganisms and bacteria formed, and I guess the bacteria before that. But, you know, and it's all going to keep changing. You know, I believe the Earth takes care of itself, and mankind is nothing but an infestation on this Earth that is going to be shrugged off eventually by the cleansing of the Earth when our sun goes supernova, and that'll be the end of all mankind. But, you know, it's interesting to see the scientists and people talk about all these things, you know. You know, they found so many things in fossil records and been able to study things, like even the lava granules from ancient lava flows in Hawaii. You know, how our poles have changed, magnetic poles have changed. And, you know, this food that comes out of erosion at this time is what we have now. Who knows what it may be a millennium from now? You know, it's just going to keep changing. And man probably isn't doing any good by any fact, but I just believe that the Earth will cleanse itself eventually. It's always trying to do that. And it's interesting to listen to this discussion.
Bob, yeah, thank you. I think
go ahead, Steve. Do you want to comment on that?
I'm just going to toss it to you in a second here, Jeremy, but I do want to bring this up. A lot of that kind of, when you start talking about how many changes of the Earth and so forth, it's on such a much longer time scale of what it is that we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is not even the blink of an eye, you know, compared to eons that it took. I mean, there's been all sorts of magnetic reversals and so forth that took place over a long period of time. This is more a case of something happening really quite fast in geologic terms, wouldn't you say, Jeremy?
Absolutely. And Bob, thank you for calling. There are a couple of things that I just want to make sure that people understand. You know, the ocean was never so acidic that it would dissolve a nail. We have to think about acidity in terms of lowering the pH of the ocean. The ocean is never going to be an acid. It's never going to burn your skin or dissolve metal. We're talking about a change in the pH, with the pH going down, which is, we refer to that as becoming more acidic. But the ocean will always sort of be on that basic side of the pH scale, above 7.0. But Steve's absolutely right. The changes that you were describing, Bob, happened over hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years. So from an evolutionary standpoint, the ocean changed, but it changed on a relatively slow pace. We are causing changes in the ocean today that are orders of magnitude faster than that. So what was taking hundreds of thousands of years is now taking decades to happen. And the concern is that the species that we rely on from a commercial standpoint just won't have the adaptive capacity to change change on that time scale. And you're also right that the oceans have always been productive, and they always will be productive. Their ocean acidification isn't going to kill all life in the ocean. But if we've built our economy and we've built our subsistence survival around certain species, and those species may end up being affected by ocean acidification, then I think that's where we have to think seriously about resiliency strategies and mitigation strategies that can help us deal with those challenges.
Bob, you still there?
Well, I hope I don't see the day when a giant circle hook eating halibut comes up out of Cook Inlet and eats the city of Anchorage. I think that's way off in the future. But thank you, guys. I appreciate your program.
All right, Bob. I enjoyed your speculation. I will say that. We're speaking with Jeremy Mathis of the NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, and the subject is sour oceans. And a very good point there, Jeremy. It's not that the ocean turns acid. It's not going to do that. It's just going to become less alkaline. Let's go to Greg, joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Greg.
Hey, good morning, guys.
How are you?
I'm all right. Back problems, but I'll be okay. I have a question. Couple months ago, there was a documentary about killer whales in the receding ice pack there west of Greenland. And I was wondering, along with the surveillance of the waters, I was wondering if any odd, behavior with the animal or the marine life. And that's, well, mainly your call.
Greg, yeah, thank you very much. And I think there's tons. I think the short answer is tons.
Okay, have a good morning.
All right. Yes, Jeremy, you want to go ahead on this? I know you're a chemist, but still.
Absolutely. That's a very important question. It's a great question to ask, because the first round of experiments that we conducted to gauge the impact of ocean acidification were focused on things that had a shell. So whether it was a coral reef or a crab or a clam or an oyster, we wanted to see whether those shells dissolved or whether those organisms struggled to maintain a healthy physiology under acidified or more acidified conditions. But now the science is sort of evolving into looking at animals that don't have a shell, things like a killer whale or fish species that may have a physiological response to ocean acidification that has nothing to do with what we call calcification, which is the building and maintaining of shells. And the scientific understanding of that is really still unresolved at this point. There have been some species of fish that have shown some neurological impacts and some behavioral impacts when they've been exposed to acidified water conditions, water where the pH is lower, but we've still got a long way to go. So I can't say anything about killer whales. I don't know if anybody has really looked at killer whales specifically on how they would be impacted just from ocean acidification. But the byproduct of ocean acidification may be a disruption in some lower levels of the food web. So something that a killer whale may feed on could ultimately be impacted by ocean acidification. So we've got two challenges right now. The first one is to understand the direct effects of how a whale or another marine mammal or a fish species would be impacted by ocean acidification. And then a secondary understanding has to be the food web implications, that if we removed or if there was some decline in a critical species that another animal fed on, to be able to quantify that impact. So those are two areas where there's still lots of work to be done, but progress is being made.
Yeah, and direct answer to Greg, as far as like vessels out to making observations, are they also seeing changes in wildlife? I think the answer is definitely yes. Everywhere they look, they're seeing changes in wildlife, range changes.
Absolutely. The ecosystem can certainly change, and we are seeing evidence of that. But that brings us into the multi-stressor discussion of this, is that ocean acidification isn't happening in a vacuum. There's warming temperatures. There's habitat loss. There's increased runoff of freshwater. So there are a number of other stressors that can go into ecosystem change, and ocean acidification is just one component of that. And so we've got to make sure that we don't become myopic and just thinking about the impacts of ocean acidification. We have to think about it in the context of all the other stressors that the ecosystems are currently facing.
Yeah, I'm looking at the table on page 4 of that article that we were talking about fisheries assessment, ocean acidification and fisheries, and noticing, for instance, about Dungeness crab, a species of great concern in Southeast, and it's not really clear that there would be a problem with them. It's a temporary acid base shift followed by compensation.
That's right. So what we're seeing from some of these species is that animals that have a fairly large depth range, so an organism that can go from a few meters of water down to several hundred meters of water, has a greater tolerance for ocean acidification because they're exposed to a broader set of conditions. So the Dungeness crab in its natural environment goes from fairly high pHs near the surface to much lower pHs when it goes down into deeper water, so it has some natural adaptive capacity to deal with those changes. Or another organism that stays pretty static at a certain depth level and doesn't really experience a variety of pH levels has a lower tolerance to conditions as they become more acidic.
And then that
sort of makes sense that that species that are exposed to more variety in their environment have a greater tolerance to stressors.
Yeah, you've got one category called ecologically important species, and haven't seen a larval effect on shrimp. However, copepod not so lucky. That's a huge base of the food chain right there.
That is true, but then again, that does get back into the diversity of the response, and it's something that we still don't understand nearly as well enough as we should, of why some species seem to be affected while other species don't.
Yeah, and generally speaking, finfish you don't see near the problem that you see with shellfish.
We don't see the direct effect on finfish to date. I have a colleague, Dr. Tom Hurst, who's down at the Alaska Fishery Science Center in Newport, Oregon, that's just starting to do some really long-term physiological and behavioral effect studies on fish that have been exposed to more acidic ocean conditions, and that'll be an emerging field over the next few years as we extend those experiments longer and longer to see, that a fish might not have an immediate impact within the first few weeks of an experiment when it's exposed to more acidified conditions. But if you let that same fish stay in that water for 2 or 3 years and go through a couple of reproduction cycles, then there may be some cumulative effect that begins to show up. So that's an area of study that's going strong right now, and something that we'll be looking very closely at in the future.
Yeah. So generally speaking, there was hardly any money for this for quite a while, and now I think it seems like they've opened the taps a little bit, and people are actually building bigger tanks and getting funding to do this type of lab work now.
And that's absolutely correct. A few years ago, the NOAA Ocean Acidification Program was created and had a fairly robust budget. But now, in this past budget cycle, they actually got about a $2 million increase in funding that's going to allow enhanced studies and longer-term research opportunities to begin to look at some of the biological effects. And then, obviously, the state of Alaska has stepped up in a big way. Several years ago, we went to the legislature and we made our case for why this was important, and they provided the funding that's allowed us to build the observational network that we rely on today to provide both the time and space measurements that we need. And that's the most of that work is actually being done out of the Ocean Acidification Research Center up in Fairbanks.
Yeah, I remember that now that you bring that up. Yeah, that was noble. Let's go to Christy, joins the program from down in Ketchikan. Christy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question for Jeremy.
Go ahead.
I'm not a scientist, but I do work on the ocean. So would harvesting billions of shellfish, crab, and oysters, that I know it's a calcification, but would that have to do anything with harvesting so much of that, taking it out of the oceans, and then putting it in our landfills instead of going back into the ocean? Would that have anything to do with making the ocean acidic?
No, that's a really interesting question, but from a purely geological standpoint, no, it's not even a drop in the ocean in terms of the amount of carbonate that we're taking out by catching clams or crabs and not returning that carbonate back into the ocean. The earth, there's the natural weathering process of mountains breaking down and dissolving into streams, and that's how carbonate is returned to the ocean. And so the scale of those two activities is really immeasurable. So no, we're not causing ocean acidification by extracting calcifiers. But the interesting caveat to that is, because the only really mechanism for returning large amounts of carbonate to the ocean is the geological weathering process, it's going to take thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years to return the ocean back to levels that it was in terms of pH before the Industrial Revolution. So while we've made a significant change over the last 200 years, it's going to take thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years for the natural weathering of carbonate rock to return the Earth's ocean pH back to those pre-industrial levels.
Okay, so crab shells and clam shells aren't made of carbonate?
They are made of carbonate, but it's such a small amount of carbonate that it doesn't really make that much of a difference in the total volume of carbonate that's in the ocean.
Okay, so we have to wait for a lot of
leaching. We have to wait for the natural process to return that carbonate back into the ocean system.
And I can understand that, especially with glaciers melting, and they're melting drastically. They are dumping in, but maybe they're not dumping in the same amount of minerals they did before.
Well, that's a great question, and that's a big study that we've just finished up in Prince William Sound this year. Is glacial meltwater doesn't have very much carbonate in it, because the glaciers are melting right off of the face of the glacier, and so they're not running down stream beds or through rivers where they're collecting carbonate.
Wow.
And so we find that glacial meltwater is low in carbonate, and so in a place like Prince William Sound, where there are big plumes of glacial meltwater that are occur in the summertime, that can actually create environments that can be harmful to something like a pteropod shell. So while the glacial meltwater itself has nothing to do with CO2-driven ocean acidification, it's another factor that increases the vulnerability of Alaska's coastal waters to the overall effect of ocean acidification.
Christy, that's some great questions. Thank you.
Those are wonderful.
Okay.
All right.
I'm just glad I don't feel guilty for not throwing the shells back in the ocean.
No,
you shouldn't feel guilty, Christy. And I'm through Ketchikan all the time, so maybe we catch up the next time I come through there.
That sounds good. I'm a sea otter seal hunter, so you just ask anybody about the girl who does sea otter hunting and sewing, and you'll find her.
All right, I certainly will.
Thanks, Christy. Okay. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. The state of Alaska reminds you to file online for your 2015 PFD on MyPFD. Paper applications are located at distribution sites in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
Well, that's quite an eye-opener. We just learned that basically the water that comes out of our glaciers is already no help to the acidification state of the ocean at all. And there's more and more of that fresh water coming in. And we also learned that the way that the Earth bounces back from these conditions is going to take a very long time compared to how quickly our oceans are turning sour. Jeremy Mathis is with us, director of the Ocean Environment Research Division of NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, by phone from Seattle. And Jeremy, I think I sort of do want to turn to this, because we were just talking to Ketchikan, this issue of these vulnerabilities that you were putting together, because one thing that this paper says in Progress in Oceanography is that Southeast Alaska is particularly vulnerable to ocean acidification.
That's absolutely correct. And so if I can walk you through some of the basics of the study, because it wasn't just looking at ocean acidification, what we wanted to know is what the societal impacts of any potential disruption caused by ocean acidification could lead to. And so we worked with an economist, Steve Colt, who's a professor at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and we worked with some social scientists. And so we went well beyond just the chemical understanding of ocean acidification. And we looked at each borough in the state of Alaska, and we started asking simple questions like how much revenue is generated from the fishing sector in each one of these boroughs every year, and that gave us a baseline sort of level of understanding. And then we looked at how those species that those different communities rely on might be impacted by ocean acidification. And then we took one more step further on shore and said, all right, how would these communities respond to a loss of income? What are the job opportunities? What are the training opportunities or educational opportunities? What is what we refer to as the protein replacement cost? If somebody couldn't go and catch and fill up their freezers with salmon every year and suddenly had to buy chicken to replace that protein, what would the cost to individual families and the economies in those boroughs, what kind of burden would that create? And so we did this very holistic approach, looking from the ocean all the way into the economic impacts into the individual communities, and we came up with this risk assessment. And really, not surprisingly, we found that Southeast Alaska and Southwest Alaska do have the highest level of vulnerability according to this index that we created, because they're heavily reliant on the fishing industry, both from a commercial standpoint and a subsistence standpoint, and there isn't a great deal of economic diversity in those communities, particularly in southwestern Alaska. People rely very heavily on the fisheries for both commercial and subsistence activities. And so if there were going to be a disruption in that, it would be a challenge for those communities to respond.
Yeah. So what can, when you talk about resilience, what's the next step here? I mean, knowing all this, you know, we have our emergency services people that are sort of directed towards first responding, but we don't really have a resilience type of planning thrust, you know?
That's absolutely true, and we're trying very hard to establish that. We've thought about creating what we call a blue ribbon panel on ocean acidification for the state of Alaska, where we bring in stakeholders and residents from a number of different places around the state to think about mitigation strategies and resilience activities that we could do. And some of it's simple. We can do things like reduce other environmental stressors, whether it be sewage runoff into an area or increase nutrient runoff into a place. Anything that's going to stress the ecosystem more is going to make it that much more vulnerable to the effects of ocean acidification. And then we can think about the communities themselves, of diversifying the economies in high and moderate risk areas and providing things like job training and educational opportunities so that the fishing industry isn't the only industry in a number of these places. And I you know, you have to think about it like a stock portfolio, that you don't want to put your entire retirement savings into one stock. You want to diversify your stock portfolio to give yourself as much insurance and resiliency as possible against any disruption in one or two particular stocks. And I think we have to take that same approach in Alaska when we start thinking about how we're going to prepare the state and prepare the economies in some of these places for what may come due to ocean acidification.
Well, you know, I'm thinking there are few people who are as accustomed to adapting as fishermen. When you get right down to it.
And that's absolutely true. I tell the story while I'm back in Washington, D.C. all the time. I'm talking to our legislatures and doing visits on Capitol Hill, and I say that more than anything else, is Alaska is the most resilient, resourceful place I've ever seen. Back in the 80s when there was a big shift and the shrimp fishery in the Gulf of Alaska went away, the fishermen down there turned around and started catching something else. When the Exxon Valdez spill happened and the herring population declined, the fishing community was able to quickly transition to something else. So that resiliency and that can-do mentality is built in to these populations and to the residents and stakeholders. We just have to make sure we're doing everything we can to provide them with the understanding and the tools they need to make those well-informed decisions. And if a transition is needed, that we're supporting them as much as we can in those transitions.
Yeah, we're speaking with Jeremy Mathis of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory by phone from Seattle, and Lindy Ann joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Lindy Ann.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
I've been reading a book called The Biochar Solution.
I'm so glad that somebody's bringing up biochar.
Well, it excited me because having been on the Economic Development Commission down here in Homer, I realized our dependency on fishing was going to be directly affected by ocean acidification. And so I was electrified as I was reading this book to hear that when biochar, and I'll explain what biochar is in a minute, when biochar is incorporated into soils in large quantities, the soils begin to sequester carbon dioxide.
Yeah, Lindy, and I would add, you do know that we've had a biochar expert on this program, right?
No, I did not know that. Must have missed that show.
Yeah, we really did. The minute I found out about the technology, I got hold of one of the top people in the world about it, and had them on the show to talk about it. And I think the potential is really exciting. You know, I want to try and get right back to ocean acidification, but go on ahead with make your case here, Lindy Ann.
Well, just briefly, we have plenty of fuel, waste wood that nothing else can be done with here on the Kenai Peninsula for sure, and that waste wood should just be turned into biochar. And then either incorporated into soils here on the Kenai Peninsula, where, by the way, we'd like to grow acres and acres of industrial agricultural hemp, which also will help to reduce ocean acidification. But anyway, once the soils here are all biochar amended, then we'd like to export biochar by the ton to areas of the world where the soils have been depleted, and let those soils start being biochar amended as well. That's the case. And we can turn around ocean acidification. It happened back in the Amazon when the white men came and tens of millions of South Americans were wiped out and the jungles grew up and obliterated their agricultural civilization. Europe went into the little ice age.
Oh, that is something there, Lindy Ann. I'm really enjoying this.
Well, I'll let you get back to ocean acidification,
okay.
But what I want people to know is don't lose hope. There are things we can do.
Great.
Well, absolutely. That is a great point, Lindy. And I'm certainly not an expert on biochar, but I can tell you that anything that gets CO2 out of the atmosphere and into a long-term land, what we call a sink, where it's stored for long periods of time, is something that we should be looking at closely. So it sounds like you guys are well on your way. I'm not surprised. I'm always amazed at how proactive Homer is for finding solutions. So you're absolutely correct that we should not lose hope. There are things that we can do, and this sounds like something that we should be looking closely at.
Yeah, they have all the beetle-killed trees down there, you know, and if it can be made into charcoal in some way that, you know, is not a carbon deal, it might really have something going. Yeah, thanks, Lindy Ann, for that. And let's see, we had one from Bruce here by email. He just said, do you think the funding is adequate through NOAA for this now?
Actually, yes. I think we're doing a very good job with our funding now. As we want to see the funding ramp up over time, so that as our capabilities become greater, we're able to take advantage of the resources and the technology that we have. So, yes, I think we are on a very good trajectory in terms of our funding right now. We want to see it to continue to increase, but we're on a really positive trajectory right now.
We're speaking with Jeremy Mathis of NOAA's Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
So one little quote from Ocean Acidification Risk Assessment for Alaska's Fishery Sector. This one on page 9. The fastest future change in acidification is projected for the Gulf of Alaska, which would lead to a shoaling of the aragonite saturation horizon by 179 m. I don't know what m is.
Meters. That's meters.
By 2100. By 2100, all waters around Alaska are projected to be perennially undersaturated with regard to aragonite. That's sobering.
Well, that's unfortunately true. Is if we stay on the current emission scenarios that we're looking at today, if we keep emitting CO2 the way that we are today, that by the year 2100, all of our oceans around Alaska, the Gulf of Alaska, the Bering Sea, and the Arctic Ocean, will be undersaturated with respect to aragonite, which is one of the carbonate minerals that we looked at. Year-round, that's what perennially means, is that the conditions will be such that for the whole year, our oceans will be undersaturated.
And this is a chemical equation. This is not one of those climate change denial issues.
No, this is pretty straightforward, that if we keep emitting CO2 the way that we are today, that change is going to happen. We are very confident in that.
Let's go to Cheryl during the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Cheryl.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Jeremy. This is Cheryl Rosa from Arctic Research Commission.
Oh, great to hear from you.
Hey, Cheryl. How are you?
Yeah, I've been listening in. Thanks. This is a great show, and I'm really happy that you guys are doing this. I've got a question about biotoxins. The commission has an interest and has been having some preliminary talks with ANTHC about doing some climate change workshops, and one of the ones that we've been interested in is focusing on biotoxins, things like paralytic shellfish poisoning, things that subsistence consumers might be exposed to. And we have largely been focusing in on the impacts of climate change related to warming waters and some of the differences we've seen in some of the incidents of these outbreaks. Now, I haven't heard much, and I'm not aware of research that's looking into the effects of OA on biotoxins and the incidence and prevalence of some of these outbreaks. Do you have any information on that, Jeremy?
I don't. I am not a biotoxin expert. I know that early on when ocean acidification was just emerging as a topic, people were wondering if ocean acidification would increase the intensity or the frequency of these biotoxic, the harmful algal bloom events. And the jury is still really out on that right now. So I don't know. It's a field of science that hasn't really kept up. We were so focused on other things like the immediate responses of things like oysters and pteropods and clams that the biotoxin question hasn't really been at the forefront with respect to ocean acidification, but it's certainly something we need to, I think, look at and think about more closely.
All right, great. Maybe this will be something for the new goals report.
Absolutely. You guys put that in your report, and I bet it makes its way into somebody's priority list of funding.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, Cheryl, I was also thinking that those workshops are probably good because the fact of the matter is we're going to have to be proactive in terms of managing for the increased presence of these biotoxins, no matter what.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for your call, Cheryl.
You're welcome.
It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's go to Nome and Rob. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Rod.
Hey, good morning. Good morning from Nome, and thanks for your show. I would like to know what this acidification does to the phytoplankton, which produces 80% of our oxygen on Earth. You can cut down all the trees in the world, and we will still have oxygen from that phytoplankton. And I just want to know what the problem with this acid is going to do to our phytoplankton and our air.
I'm dying to hear the answer there. Let's see what Jeremy can tell us, Rod.
So the simple answer is we don't quite know yet. The phytoplankton that he's referring to are just the plant life that lives in the ocean. And so when you think about it from just a very simplistic standpoint, these are plants in the ocean just like plants grow on land. And so there is some thinking that in a warmer world, we know the oceans are getting warmer, and it's going to have more carbon dioxide, which is what plants love to have, that we may actually see an expansion of phytoplankton, that the plants growing in the ocean may thrive under a warmer, higher CO2 condition. So there may not be a big effect from ocean acidification directly or on phytoplankton, but there's a caveat with that though. If we start having a tremendous amount of phytoplankton growing in the surface ocean, all of that phytoplankton eventually dies and it sinks down to the bottom, where it's respired by bacteria. It's broken down by bacteria just like plants rot on Earth. And when that happens in the ocean, it uses up all the oxygen in the bottom waters of the ocean. So on the one hand, it's good because you've got phytoplankton producing oxygen at the surface and consuming carbon dioxide. But all of that carbon dioxide is transported to the bottom as this stuff dies, and it can create conditions what are called hypoxia, where low oxygen events happen in different places in the ocean, and that can be harmful to marine life. It can kill fish, and we see instances of that in places like the Gulf of Mexico, where there's a big hypoxic event every summer, that's caused by fertilizers that come down the Mississippi River. Well, the same thinking could apply in certain places if higher CO2 levels cause a greater growth or a more sustained growth of phytoplankton in the ocean. So we don't know what the net effect is going to be yet. That we don't see evidence that ocean acidification itself is really bad for phytoplankton, but we do know that the sort of secondary effect of increased phytoplankton growth and sinking in the ocean could worsen the effects of ocean acidification in some places. So I know that's a complicated answer, but it's something that's still emerging, and our understanding of it is still coming along.
You know, when you look at a coccolithophore, a picture of it, it's got a really, really interesting shell and a lot of it. And with warmer water, sometimes we get these big blooms of these things, and they can actually cause mortality in seabirds because they make the water so cloudy they can't see their prey underneath it. And we are getting that increasingly, and they're also getting it in other northern latitudes increasingly. I'm wondering if more acidic water maybe impedes the shell formation of coccolithophores.
Well, that's another really complicated question that we're starting to see in the Bering Sea right now. The coccolithophore blooms don't normally happen in the Bering Sea. It was about a once-a-decade event that because they need warmer water to grow. And now we're seeing an increased number of coccolithophore blooms in the Bering Sea. And I have a one of the young women, Dr. Jessica Cross, that works at the Ocean Acidification Research Center in Fairbanks and also here in Seattle, just published a paper last year about the effects of increased coccolithophore blooms in the Bering Sea and the impact that that would have on ocean acidification. So it's a changing environment, and so we're trying to capture a baseline of understanding an environment that's changing so rapidly that I'm not sure it has a baseline at this time. So the coccolithophore question is another great one for what ultimately a new ecosystem could look like in some of these regions around Alaska.
Hannah joins the program from Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Hannah.
Thanks. This is Hannah Heimbach in Homer. I'm a salmon fisherman and a halibut fisherman in the Gulf of Alaska and a fisheries organizer for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. And I just wanted to thank you guys for continuing the discussion and outreach about this. The young fishermen that I know and work with here and around the state are very interested in and very concerned about ocean acidification and the resiliency of our fisheries and essential habitats and the ecosystem. So thanks for your work. It continues to be really important to the next generation of Alaska seafood workers.
Yeah, and
thank you,
I think
Hannah.
It's
you guys. You know, Homer has been our base of operation since I got started in this 6 or 7 years ago now. So the support that you guys provide in the community and through your advocacy has the reason why we've had the success that we've had.
Yeah, I think we should say when it comes to salmon that we don't really quite know. We know that the pinks at a certain life stage do pasture on the very vulnerable pteropods. The other ones, we're not so sure.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We don't know what the effects are on halibut particularly, but we do know that there may be some connection between the salmon and the pteropods and what that could mean as an important prey source for the salmon.
Let's go down to Dorothy, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dorothy.
Thank you, Steve. Dr. Mathis, I'm just wondering if you could reflect a little bit on how fishermen and people in the seafood industry and other coastal Alaskans who are dependent on marine and coastal systems, how can they keep track of the science? You know, I mean, you've worked a lot on monitoring and fostering a lot of research.
Okay, you got 20 seconds, Dorothy. Let's try and get an answer.
Well, I think the biggest way, thank you, Dorothy, I think the biggest opportunity is to come to the Alaska Marine Science Symposium every year. That's the one-stop shopping for everything we've learned about ocean acidification to this point. So I would encourage as many community leaders and fishermen as they can to come to AMSS and hear us talk or schedule side meetings with us, that we're always happy to talk to people about their concerns and about their interest and we're always there, so please take advantage of that.
Great. Oh, thank you so much for that question. Jeremy Mathis, thanks for being with us on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve. It's always a pleasure.
And thanks so much to Dave Waldron at the controls and Josh Edge on the phones. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.